This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wildon Acosta was 17 years old when he came to North Carolina. He attended Riverside High School with dreams of graduating and going on to college and then becoming an engineer. That dream was interrupted when he was picked up by immigration officers on his way to school. Wildon was detained last January and sent to a detention center in Georgia to await deportation to Honduras. His case galvanized the local community. Congressman G.K. Butterfield intervened on his behalf to prevent his deportation. Immigration activists, teachers, and students raised $10,000 that he needed in bond money to secure his release. And his return to Durham in early August was cause for celebration by his family and friends. Wildon is now seeking asylum. He's back in school. He awaits a review of his request. I sat down with Wildon Acosta earlier this month, and we recorded the interview so Wildon would not have to miss school. Wildon is most comfortable speaking in his native Spanish, so interpreter Ron Vasquez was with us as well, and I began by welcoming him to the show.
Gracias, te lo agradezco.
Thank you for this interest in covering this news and what's going on with my life.
Me está pasando mi vida.
Well, let's hear what's going on with your life, and let's start, if you would, with that day that you were detained and picked up. Tell us about that day.
Well, that morning, what can I tell you? It was 4 o'clock in the morning when I went to bed, because I was helping my girlfriend with a Spanish homework. So once we finished, I just fell asleep in bed. So then I got up like around 7, and I had already dressed. And I was heating up some water to fix some coffee. I had already changed, and then I went to take my book bag and my clothing because I was also supposed to work that day. So then that day I saw these two gentlemen there that were approaching. It was like, you know, they were in jackets and things like that, but I mean, it seemed normal. When I was about to lock my car, then one of them got in front of me, one to the side, and one behind. They approached me and they said, they asked me what my name was, and I just gave them my same name. And then they said, no, you are Wildon Acosta, and we have an order for your deportation here. They showed me a picture with the papers for my deportation. So they took off their jackets, and where I could be was police and ICE. So, you know, you can imagine how I felt. It's like the whole world was on top of me then. And, you know, what happened was that all of a sudden, I mean, I had this condition with my heart, and I don't know if it was a reaction, but, you know, you can imagine it was a big impact in your life, you know, to find out that you're going to be deported.
Let me ask you a question, because did you know this was a possibility? Obviously, you knew that you were in the country without documentation. Did you realize that this could happen at any point?
Well, yeah, there was reason to believe that there was an order for deportation, because I didn't show up for court on March 15th, 2015, because of a suggestion from an attorney with whom I had a tutorship. And so the attorney had told me that there was a 50% chance for me, you know, by not going to court, that, you know, I could be deported or I could be picked up. So you can imagine a situation for a boy, you know, who's 18 years old, who comes from a country where, you know, you're suffering from persecution, that you're at risk of getting killed. A person who has suffered so much, you know, coming here and then to find out that you're going to be deported, if you do that, then, you know, you think, well, why risk it?
Well, let's talk about that hearing. It was a hearing for you to be granted asylum, right?
Yes, that was a possibility that of being granted that, but the attorney advised that I didn't have a possibility for that.
But let's talk about that story and how it was that you came over here from Honduras. Why did you leave Honduras?
It was because the Mara 18 that controls pretty much the whole of Honduras, they threatened to kill me. This Mara 18 is getting involved in everything in the country. They're involved in politics, the police. I mean, can you imagine that even police officers are members of the Mara?
And I understand it was because of your religious conviction that they had targeted you. Am I right about that?
Yes, I'm going to tell you the story. See, that day I went to a park. I was talking about the Word of God to a group of boys who were there. There was one guy whom I thought was the leader of them. And he said, hey, listen, I don't like you talking to me about the Word of God anymore. so you better leave or else I'll kill you. And then I just said, okay, no problem, just go away from here. And as I was leaving, he said, be careful, I'll be watching for you. And I don't know how it happened, but about 3 days later, somehow he learned my phone number and started. He started threatening me. So, you know, when that happened, I just went and told my aunt that I have in Honduras about what was going on. And then she went ahead and told my mom and father. And they took action to bring me over here.
Where were your mother and father at the time?
Yeah, they were living here in Durham.
And so now, and about how old were you when you got the death threat?
I was about to turn, well, I was 16.
So you were 16 years old at the time. So now your aunt is worried about you. She tells your parents who are here in North Carolina that you've been threatened, that your life has been threatened because of your religious conviction. What did they say?
Well, my parents, you know, just like any parent you can imagine, they said, well, you just have to come here.
How seriously do we take these threats? Did you know anybody who had been killed by this gang in Honduras? And how common was it that people actually carried through on a threat like the one that you received?
I mean, what can I tell you? I have two of my uncles who were killed, as well as two of my cousins. One of my uncles was killed in a place where they have sugar canes. And then the authorities were able to find him only a month later. And then my other uncle was killed while I was here in the U.S. You know, the same situation. They took him to this mountain, and they killed him, and they burned him. They burned him alive. Can you imagine that?
So you have every reason to take this death threat seriously. You're 16 years old. What did you do next? Did you decide right then and there with your aunt and your parents that you would come to the United States?
Yes, well, my aunt told me that, well, you're going to come here. I guess she told my parents. And then 2 days or 3 days later, they sent me from Honduras. It was in the morning. I wasn't ready. I didn't know I was going to leave. They only told me about it about an hour earlier. And they tell me that I was coming over here. And I didn't have time to say goodbye to my grandparents. I mean, it all happened in 1 hour. After that, I mean, you can imagine I was crossing borders, Guatemala, Mexico, and all the way over here.
So what about when you got to the United States? What happened when you finally crossed the border? How did you get to North Carolina?
Well, once I crossed over, I was at a detention center in Arizona for 7 days. I was locked up in a room. They call them the ice boxes because they're very cold, and they don't let you out. You don't know whether it's daylight or nighttime. You don't know the time either.
So when did you finally get connected with your parents again, and how did you finally get to North Carolina?
Well, I was given a call, and I was able to call my father. That day, my father told me, well, son, look, I'm going to get your papers so that you are going to come here. And I was really happy. They had me sign this paper. It was a letter. And after that, then I had to wait for to be released. But I knew that I was going to be released the following day.
So what was it like when you finally saw your mother and father again? What would it be? It played nine years since you'd seen your father, maybe 3 years since you'd seen your mother, something like that?
It was something amazing, hard to believe. You know, it's like I knew that I was going to be released the following day, but that night I was not able to sleep. It seems this night was eternal. It was forever. I couldn't believe that I was going to be released.
And when you finally saw them, what was that like?
It was such a big emotion. I mean, when I got to the airport, I passed by my mom. I mean, I hadn't seen her. But about my dad, you know, I hadn't recognized him. Since I didn't recognize him, I just passed. And then the security from the airport told me that, you know, we passed. And then she said, but I can't see your parents. Then I realized that they were in the back. And I said, oh, yeah, that's where they are. You know? So after that, you know, we embraced each other. And, you know, I mean, we hadn't seen each other. At first, you know, it's such a big moment. It's that you don't know what to say, you know. At first, we were just looking at each other, not knowing what to say.
Well, take us back to your earliest days when you were all living together in Honduras. Tell us what your family did and what you remember about your youngest days growing up in Honduras.
Cuando tenía siete años, pues,
well, you know, when I was young, I mean, when I was 7 years old, like any normal child, you know, like you go to school and then when my father left, when I was 7 years old, I was still in school. And then when my mother left, I was in middle school in Honduras still.
What did your father do for a living when he was in Honduras?
He would help my grandfather working in the fields.
What did he say to you and the family when he left? Did you know he was going to the United States?
You know, when your father goes away at that age, it's like, you know, he's gone and he's gone. It doesn't mean so much, I guess, because at that age, when you're 7 years old, it's your mom that you are more attached to. And at that age, at 7 years old, you know, it's like all a boy thinks of is how to have fun and just do that, you know.
This is the State of Things. We're talking today with Riverside High School Wildon Acosta, and we will hear more of his story just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour is 19-year-old Wildon Acosta. I recorded a conversation with him after school one day earlier this month. Wildon was recently released on bond from the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia. He is seeking asylum in the U.S., and his case is awaiting review at the Charlotte Immigration Court. He was joined by interpreter Ron Vasquez. Before the last break, we were talking about his life in his native Honduras. Wildon left Honduras after an incident at a local park. He was discussing his faith openly, and that angered a local gang member. He subsequently received a death threat. Two of his family members were murdered by gangs, so he had every reason to take that threat seriously. With the help of his family, he made plans to flee to the United States. I began this segment by asking him if it was common for people from his town to leave their town and come to the United States.
Well, at that age, I guess, you know, I just saw it as it was common. But as I was growing up, I kind of understood better what was going on. I understood that parents were trying to look for a better life and a better future.
What were your ideas about your future? What were you expecting to do as a young man? And what were your dreams growing up in Honduras?
Well, when I was at the age of 16, you know, my plan was just to study and then continue going to the university. And I was attending the equivalent of high school here when, you know, what happened with the gangs took place, and then I had to leave over here. So my dreams of attending university in Honduras weren't a reality anymore. But I think that, you know, coming here and being here, I can still attend the university. And, you know, as I say to myself all the time, I can just work hard on anything.
So when you did get here, then you enrolled, was it pretty quickly after you arrived that you enrolled at Riverside High School?
Yes, it was quick. I just arrived here, I think it was in June, and I still had about a month to go. Because in August, I think there was some kind of vacation for a few months. So after that, I registered to school. But what happened is they lowered 1 year of my studies. They put me on 10th grade because I didn't know the language here of the United States.
Well, tell us about that adjustment. What was it like for you adjusting to high school in the United States?
One of the adjustments was that I had to register to public schools here in Durham and go to high school. That was very such a big impact because everybody spoke English except me.
Well, that had to be pretty daunting to go into a classroom where they're speaking in English, you don't speak it yet, and you're expected to take a test at the end of the week. I mean, how did you even, what did you think was going to happen at the end of the week when they gave you that test?
Well, when I got here, I took about one semester, I was taking classes of like ESL, which is like learning a second language. But, you know, nevertheless, I mean, when I arrived here from Honduras, I already had some English. I was already in level 3. Because when I was in Honduras, I had two cousins who had arrived from the U.S., and they started teaching me over there.
How much did you know about your legal situation here, and what were your expectations for staying here once you got here?
Well, you know, once I learned that I had the deportation order, I didn't really care that much. Because, I mean, I knew a lot of people who were here illegally. And, you know, in my mind, I was thinking, I'll just continue studying and eventually I'll get the opportunity to stay here.
You were picked up, and you were not alone. You were one of six students who were part of a sweep that day, or at least in that time period. Were you aware of the fact that other students like yourself were picked up as part of this sweep?
Bueno, sí tenía este.
Well, yes, because when I was picked up, you know, I am a good friend of the six friends that you're talking about. So I was picked up on a Thursday, and then someone else was picked up on a Friday, and we got to meet each other in this room in Cary. With him, you know, we went together through the in all our trajectory, going through Winston-Salem, Jor, South Carolina, and Irving, which are detention centers.
So all of this time, before you finally ended up in that privately owned detention center in Georgia, what were you thinking that was going to happen to you?
What I was thinking, I don't know, I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's like, I mean, in my mind, you know, I didn't really know, but I mean, I was aware that there were a lot of people from my community that were supporting me, people from Congress, from Washington that were supporting me. But, you know, when you're inside, you don't know what's going on. You know, the detention center and the Stewart detention center, there's no communication. There's very little communication as to the outside.
You were in the Stewart detention center in Lumpkin, Georgia. What kind of contact did you have with your attorneys or any kind of legal assistance?
Well, when I was picked up, I think a week went by and I already had an attorney. And when I was talking to my attorneys, you know, they would give me the possibility, but they would just say it's the community of Durham and my organization. They're trying to do everything possible to get you out of here, out of this situation. But you know, my attorneys would just tell me, you know, we have to wait, and we have to continue because, see, the communities and the organizations and everything, they could only put pressure on the situation, but they don't know for a fact whether immigration answer is going to be yes or no. We just have to wait.
And the question you wanted answered is whether you could be granted asylum. Is that right?
Yes, that was the answer I was waiting. I mean, can you imagine? I was there for 5 months and 21 days waiting for that answer.
Now, they will say, well, you had a hearing scheduled, and that was for to be granted asylum, and you didn't go.
Well, for a young man of 18, you know, I mean, when you get bad advice from an attorney, I would like to know what you would do. You know, it's like, I mean, you're talking about an 18-year-old with an attorney who advises, you know, it's a 50-50 chance you can get it or don't. But I like to know people's opinion when they ask me this question. You know, I like to know what other people think about this. Were they in the same situation? I mean, if you were in my shoes, I would like to know what you would do.
And this is a former attorney. You no longer have this attorney, right?
No,
not anymore. But the same way you asked me that question, are you aware that in 2014, everybody who would be going to court, they were going to be deported? Did you know that?
There's a high percentage, particularly your court would have been in Charlotte. I think the last time I saw the approval rate for asylum request was something around 13%, and that would compare to 48% nationally.
Well, I think you are right. I've also seen in the news that it's 13% that there is a chance that they might accept it, and there's 87% that you could be deported.
Tell us about your living conditions in the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia. What was it like for you there?
Well, the situation there is pretty bad. Can you imagine, three or four times I had food that had worms. I mean, the whole food there, it's really, really bad. But let's look at this. I mean, my mom was paying about $300 a month to the prison so that I would be able to communicate with her on the phone number or, like, to my number because you get a PIN number when you get there.
Did you feel safe in that detention center?
I mean, it's not like you're going to be mistreated physically. You know, nothing's going to happen physically to you, but mentally, you get destroyed.
How so?
Imagínate.
I mean, you can imagine a young man needs freedom, but all you can do over there is just lie down and think and think and think and think. I mean, all you do is just think. Thousands of thoughts. I mean, there's nothing to do. I mean, there were some TV sets over there, but all you do is just look at the screen and you can hear anything.
You were aware, you said right away, that you had supporters. Did you know that fellow students and teachers were getting together to support you, to gather not only political support but money? And then G.K. Butterfield, the congressman, that you had the support. How aware of all of that were you during your time that you were there?
Yes, I was aware, and I'll tell you the truth. I think my case turned political. Because my case just gained attention at the national level.
So how do you feel about that?
Well, because of all that, my case, my situation also changed, because it's not a situation that has to do with the courts, but it's a situation that has to do with politics.
Well, I'm curious about that and about your position now as someone who's in a position to speak out about that. And I'm thinking about a case very recently, a student at Durham School for Creative Studies, Ingrid Portillo Hernandez, was deported to El Salvador. And I'm wondering, what kind of impact do you think your story has on these kind of cases?
Well, I am aware of Ingrid Portillo. I know about her. With the organization that I am with, we realized about that situation, about that case, but we tried to communicate with that family, but we weren't able to. But then when we were able to, it was already late.
What impact does this have on the schools? Obviously, there was a lot of support for you. You're back in Riverside now. When students are taken away from their fellow students, can you tell now how your fellow students felt now that you've been able to go back and talk with them?
Well, yes, I do know how a student feels when he's deported, because I went through that. And the truth is that there are many students who are undocumented, just like I am. And I think they are afraid of talking, and until it's too late, until a situation happens, and only then they start to talk.
And I'm wondering, too, about the effect on students and teachers who aren't in at any risk of deportation and who lose students among them, who know that at any moment there might be students who are undocumented who they may not be there that day. Did you have any sense of what effect this had on the school while you were gone?
Well, when I was arrested and I was taken to the detention center, I saw that there were a lot of students that I learned that they were leaving high school because... I think that ICE was breaking this federal rule that, you know, which they were not supposed to arrest students at the bus stop, and that's exactly what they were doing.
What about now? You're still pressing your asylum case, right? Where is your case right now in the legal system?
Well, honestly, you know, I will always identify myself as an undocumented, but I don't have a deportation order anymore. They can't do anything to deport me. And so I'm just waiting for my permit for my asylum, which is going to take about 2 years. Or, I mean, it could take a long time also, let me tell you.
But it also could possibly be denied. Am I right about that? Has it been granted and you're just waiting for the paperwork? Or is there still a possibility that your request could be denied?
Well, let's put it this way. I know that North Carolina and Georgia are one of the most difficult states where you can get an asylum granted. But when I was released from Georgia, I went in front of the judge in Georgia and the politicians, and I showed that I'm not a bad person. And if I already shown that in Georgia, then I think I can get it over here as well. I can even tell you that when I was here already released, I was able to talk to the home security.
Jay Johnson?
Yeah, Jay Johnson.
And so when we were talking, and I know that you realized that we were talking privately, he and I, he told me that the decision was taken, that, you know, along with other politicians, some other names that he from Washington that he wouldn't give me. But he said that the decision was made because I had already shown that I was not a bad boy to live here in the United States.
So you heard from Jay Johnson, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security, personally in a conversation that your asylum will be coming through.
No,
not that my asylum was going to be granted, but they had made the decision of let me release in freedom where I was.
So they won't press your deportation?
No.
Let me ask you about that, because you talked to Jay Johnson when he appeared at Duke University recently. Before you had that private audience, you were demonstrating in the auditorium and interrupting his speech, and your asylum hadn't been granted. Why did you take that step? It seems like a pretty risky step for a guy who could be sent back any moment.
Yes, the reason why I did that is because I still have two friends who were there, detained, and I promised them that once I would be released, that I would do anything to help them to be released. And then I told my friends that, and also about the asylum, you know, I'm not afraid, because I knew that I didn't have a deportation order anymore, and I wanted to talk to the Secretary of Homeland Security and ask him why they were doing that.
What did he say?
Well, you can imagine, I mean, as a politician, they're well prepared to answer any question. So I didn't receive the answer that I was looking for. I mean, you can imagine, I mean, he was prepared as I was prepared.
Well, what about this? Your situation now, you have been elevated to, in some ways, celebrity status. Your case is well known. You are often asked to speak about this. You're a 19-year-old young man. How do you feel about being in this position as a kind of spokesman for this cause?
Well, what I feel is, what can I tell you? It's like a big responsibility on top of me. One, because I met a lot of guys, a lot of people saying, they tell me that I'm a big inspiration for them. They said, because you're doing this. So, I mean, it's a lot of responsibility, because it's not like a young 19-year-old thinking about, you know, I want to do a lot of things. You know, people look at you and then see what you're doing. You can't think like a young man anymore.
Do you think about a future? I think at one point you had intended to be an engineer, if I'm right about that. Is that still a possibility? Do you think you will move on beyond this and have a different kind of life? Or do you think you'll be doing this pretty much for the rest of your life?
Well, about engineering, I mean, I still think about it, but there are a lot of things now that are happening that I'm interested in. And, I mean, I'm a senior now, so I haven't made a decision yet about what to study later on, but I think that by November I will.
So your faith is what led to the death threat in Honduras. Is faith still an important part of your life?
Yes, it's a big importance still. You always have to have faith. You know, when you're detained, I think you need... you need more faith, and I got closer to God, you know, with my religion and my faith, and the idea of thinking that it is possible, because you doubt everything. You know, I even doubted that I was going to be able to be released, because you have no answers.
Wildon Acosta, thank you so very much for talking with us.
No de nada. Te lo agradezco a ti por haber escuchado.
You're welcome. I thank you for having listened to me.
That was Wildon Acosta. He's a student at Riverside High School in Durham, and we were assisted by Ron Vasquez, interpreting from Spanish to English. Wildon Acosta is seeking asylum in the United States. His case is awaiting review at the Charlotte Immigration Court. Coming up, we have not forgotten that it's Halloween. We have some ghost stories for you, courtesy of local author Nicole Sirocco. Her new book is called Ill-Mannered Ghosts, an occasionally true account of hillbilly Stonehenge, occult cleaning products, the lady in the picture, and the blood-curdling tale of Crybaby Lane. That story is just ahead on The State of Things. Stay tuned.